there was a day when there was a reporter and that called in sick, and there was a Garden Games story about a giant squash that looked like Elvis Presley, and we had to go cover it.
Hey y'all, I'm Tommy Tomlinson, and from WFAE in Charlotte, this is Southbound. Conversations with people from all walks of life about how the South shapes who they are and what they do. Christy Woodson Harvey has come a long way from that Elvis-looking squash. She's a New York Times bestselling author of 11 novels, including her newest, A Happier Life, which comes out June 25th. She's also part of the popular online show Friends in Fiction, along with three other authors. And she does a design blog on the side with her mom. So we talk about time management, for one thing, and also the inspiration for her new book and how she navigates her writing life. But first, we talk about where she lives, Beaufort, North Carolina, which looks the same, but is not pronounced the same, as Beaufort, South Carolina. Here's our conversation. The first question I have to ask you is, how many times a week do you have to correct somebody who has pronounced the name of the town you're living in wrong?
A lot, several. But the best thing is that I'll be on the road somewhere and I'll say, oh, I live in Beaufort, you know, North Carolina. And people say, oh, you mean Beaufort. And it always makes me laugh because I think, like, imagine if it was. Imagine if I lived in a town and didn't know how to say it properly.
Yeah, that poor woman, she doesn't know how to say her own town's name.
She writes books and she can't say the name of her town. Bless her heart.
So there's an interesting thing in that I've read about you, that you sort of went to Beaufort years and years ago and kind of dreamed about living there one day, and then it happened, right?
Yes, it's so bizarre. And it's actually something that it took me a few years to even really realize and remember that that had happened. But I was, I think, 19 the first time I ever went to Beaufort. And I was with some friends from college and we drove over the bridge and I was like, I'm going to live here one day. Of course, that was a ridiculous thing to say because I think the town had a population of about 3,100 at the time. I think we're up to 4,000 now. So, you know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to move here and be, you know, whatever. Like, there's no real job path to live in Beaufort. And yeah, I mean, just all these things. I didn't even know my husband at the time that I said that. And then, you know, he had family here. And yeah, we bought a house here. And then a few years later, moved for, quote, a year. And we've been here full time for, I think, 8 now. So I don't think we're going anywhere. But yeah, it's crazy to me. I say it all the time now. I'm like, be careful what you wish for and what you say out loud, because it's coming back to you.
This book, A Happier Life, is set in Beaufort. And I know some of your other books are set in a town that's not explicitly Beaufort, but kind of is.
Yes.
And so I'm wondering, how much pressure do you feel to get the little details of the town right?
Okay, so that is so true. That's good research. So I had a Peachtree Bluff series that came out 2017, 18, 19, and then I did a Christmas book in 21, I guess. And that town was kind of based on Beaufort. And I say now that I feel like Peachtree Bluff was the Beaufort of my weekend trips. Like, Peachtree Bluff was the Beaufort of walking into the clean house and never paying bills here. You know, all the things, like, none of my real life would seep into life in Beaufort, I guess. And so it's maybe a little bit more of a, like, it's maybe a little more idealized version. Although, don't get me wrong, it's an amazing place to live. And I hope that comes through in A Happier Life. But I think it took me a few years of living here to feel like I could actually credibly write about what it is like to live in Beaufort. I did feel a lot of responsibility, and, you know, people are rightfully so very attached to this town, and it's very important to a lot of people, and I wanted to feel like I got it right. And my actually only real regret about it is that there are some places in Beaufort that I absolutely love that I didn't get to write about in the book because they just didn't, like, make sense in context, in the context of the story. And so now I'm like, oh gosh, I hope no one's feelings are hurt that they're not in the book.
So the places, like the restaurants and stuff, those are real places?
Those are real places, yeah. So everything I used in the book, and actually that's a really notable point. The past storyline and the present storyline, everything is real. So anything that you read, the people and the people are obviously not real. The people are fictional, but the events, the places, the timelines, like, all of those types of things are real. And in the 1935 to 1976 part. If something happened, it happened in real life, pretty much. The one exception to that is that I, for the purposes of my story, I have the old homes tour, which is one of the best parts of it, starting in 1976, and it actually started much earlier than 1976. So.
As you said, this book kind of jumps around in time, and it also has multiple narrators. Well, let me just start by asking that question. I've never tried that, and it always looks from the outside like a magic act when somebody's able to do that. Had you done that before, or what was it like for you to do that?
Yeah, do you know what's really strange is that from the very, so I have a couple of manuscripts that I wrote before my debut novel, Dear Carolina, and even those had multiple narrators and multiple points of view, which I'm not completely sure why, but every book that I've published has had at least two narrators and some three, four, or even five. But I think what I like about it is that it allows you to tell a story from different angles. Although I will say, I do try to not overlap any of the details. With a few exceptions, like there was something that I did in my Peachtree Bluff series where you see a scene three times over three books, but the purpose of it is to see how differently each of the women remember it. But in general, I'm trying not to repeat things. So I'm trying, like, if you're at a party and I'm seeing it from your point of view, I'm not going to then rehash it from somebody else's for the very most point. But I don't know. I think it's interesting to get to see the way that people's lives intersect. And for some reason, it feels less daunting to me. I actually have thought about recently, like, could I tell a story from one person's point of view? Because I do think when you tell a story from one person's point of view, you've got to know a whole lot about that person. Not that you don't. I mean, I feel like I know a lot about all my characters, but I do think, wow, 400 pages of one character is a big feat. So I feel the opposite, I think.
So did you have to get into like certain frames of mind or something for each character, or did you do you wake up, on a Monday and say, okay, today's a Townsend day and Tuesday's a Keaton day, or how do you approach like how you're doing it?
This is going to sound a little woo-woo, but this is just the truth. So when I'm starting a story, I feel like the voices usually come to me before the story does. So the beginning of a story for me is usually some voices in my head. And actually, Townsend, I thought was going to be a part of a different story. His kind of voice was the first one that I had, and I thought it was going to be a little bit of a different story, and then it ended up being a part of this one. So I feel like once I when I start, and especially in a story like A Happier Life, like I would say A Happier Life is an exception to a rule in the fact that Keaton is a 30-something woman in 2024. Rebecca St. James is, a 60-something woman in the 70s. And then, Townsend is obviously a man also in the set, but we're hearing his journal entry, so he's kind of all over the place. But I feel like their voices were a little bit easier for me as the writer to just really distinguish because they were very clear to me, like in my head, kind of who was who. And I have to say that usually I try to write 2,000 words a day. I've gotten a little bit better about trying to write more chronologically than I used to because it's easier for my timelines. But I will tell you this, like people ask me about writer's block, and I'm like, if I'm stuck on what comes next, I just write the next thing I know. And then I just hope it all comes together in the end. So I don't wake up with a plan of like, but I will tell you this, I do read, I leave myself notes every day. So if I finish like a Rebecca chapter and I know what comes next for Keaton, I go ahead and like leave myself notes about what I'm going to write the next day so that I can just pop right back into it.
There are multiple narrators in this book, and one of the narrators in this book, briefly, is the house that's at the center of the book, an abandoned house that becomes sort of the place where most of the action centers on. How'd you figure out to have the house narrate part of its own story?
I actually had an entire point of view from the house in my first draft of this book. The house had, a little section every few chapters. Part of what was interesting to me about this story, was the house. And in a lot of ways, that house is based on my house in Beaufort. And, it was in a great state of disrepair when we bought it, and people thought we were nuts. I mean, they were like, who would buy this house? Like, our friends truly were concerned. Like, they would come in and they would be like, you guys, like, you can't save this, And we were like, yes, we can. I don't know what it was. I just felt like this house had such a soul to it, and like I just needed to bring it back to life. I think there was something about like the process of that, you know, years later, like has really stuck with me. And I think a lot about, you know, the stories that a house like this that's, you know, 130 years old, which is actually very new for Beaufort. I mean, this is the houses on either side of us are from the early 1700s. So this is a newer house. But I think about all the people who have lived here and all the stories and all the lives that have been lived inside this house. And I think like the house knows. And so that was almost kind of part of the inspiration. And in a very like physical way too, you know, Keaton's cleaning out of this house is leading her to get to know her grandparents. So it's kind of in the metaphysical, like the house has seen the lives of these people, but then also in the very physical, like her cleaning it out and finding their letters and finding their journals and their jewelry and, you know, whatever it may be, that was kind of left behind and like piecing together these people and who they were. But I love houses. Houses fascinate me. And but by the time I got finished with the story, I thought, I don't really need the whole point of view from the house. I think just this is enough.
I read in an interview with you somewhere that you had also had an experience when you were younger with like friends or family or something that had gotten an old abandoned house.
Yes, so this was bizarre. So that was a true story. So when Keaton finds this house, when she comes back to her grandparents' house in Beaufort, it is truly a time capsule of the night that they left in 1976. I actually played it down a little bit because what happened to me, both my editor and my agent were like, it's not believable. This is not a believable story. But what inspired it was that our neighbors in Salisbury bought a house across the street that had literally been closed up for 50 years. And when I was one of the first people to walk back inside it, when they went to go look at the house, I was 10 years old. And we walked in the house, and the family had gotten in a big fight at Thanksgiving and just left.
Like on Thanksgiving?
On Thanksgiving, like they're at the Thanksgiving table. It's like if you were sitting at a Thanksgiving table with, you know, 12 of your family members, I don't know what the fight was about. And now I need to dig into that and figure out if I can
Yeah.
find out. But they got in a big fight, and everyone left, and no one walked back in the house. And like the turkey, the thing that sticks out to me the most is that I remember the turkey was still on the table. And you would think that after 50 years, it would have completely disintegrated or something would have eaten it or something. I mean, right? But it was like wood. It was petrified on the table. Like it was
Wow.
like the skin had just, I mean, I don't know. It's really gross. But the house was not gross. It was not like a, you know, hoarder's pigsty. Like it was as though you had walked in someone's family home, dinner was set on the table. Like the newspaper was out on the couch, shoes were on the floor, children's toys were out in the rooms as though they were coming back to play with them. Like it was eerie. But I think at 10, you kind of think like, oh, this is cool. At 38, I was like, that is bizarre. Who would walk out of their house and never come back for 50 years? And why? And I think, you know, something like this, like something like a tragedy or, you know, a re there had to be a big reason why no one would walk back into this house. And so it all just kind of fit together.
Those people who knew you and know you in Salisbury, would they be or are they surprised that you're doing what you're doing?
No, they would not be surprised at all because I got my start in Salisbury. That's where I first started writing. And the town was just always really supportive of me. And I've always just been someone that, like, I liked to do a lot of things. I had a lot of things I was passionate about. And so I was always very much like in the community, I guess. And I had my first newspaper column at the Salisbury Post when I was like 16. So I
So
don't.
it's wait, to stop for a second, tell me how that happened.
Okay. So I was the editor of the Hornet, the Salisbury Hornet, our newspaper. And I don't know why, but you know when you're a teenager or like in your, I don't know, just any time when you're like maybe younger and you think, oh, well, I can do that. And I thought, you know, it would be really cool if we had a magazine. I'm going to start one. Sure. You know, now I would be like, can't do one more thing. Then I was like, oh, this will be a really great idea. So we did this whole like overhaul and my staff hated me because of course we had to pay for it. Like the newspaper was cheap, but the magazine was expensive. So we had to go out and hit the pavement and ask people for money. And I think one of our advertisers, not I think, there's one of the that one of our advertisers was the Salisbury Post, and I think they thought that that was funny and entrepreneurial, I guess. And so they offered me an internship. And I was like, yeah, I definitely want to do an internship. And the great thing about it was because I would be like, you know, at the Salisbury Post, not just some random, I got course credit for doing this internship. And so I went in and I thought, you know, I'll just be, you know, making copies for people. And it started slowly. Like at first, I think I was doing like some copy editing and proofreading. Obviously, someone was checking behind me. They weren't letting a 16-year-old like copy edit the newspaper, but I was, you know, they were putting me to work a little bit. And then there was a day when there was a reporter and that called in sick, and there was a Garden Games story about a giant squash that looked like Elvis Presley, and we had to go cover it. And somebody had to go, and I know this shocks you. Nobody wanted to go. And so I was like, I'll go, I'll do it. And so the photographer and I went out, and I ended up basically writing like a profile piece about this family who, you know, grew, you know, this crazy looking squash. And so they assigned me that, and it went really well. Like I think people liked having, you know, a 16-year-old writing for their paper. And so one day they were like, well, you can write about whatever you want. I don't know, what does a 16-year-old write about? I remember writing about there was a big ice storm in Salisbury, and the power, you might remember that, the power was out for a long time. And I wrote about kind of like the unexpected gifts and the silver linings that had come from that experience. And I wrote about, you know, applying to college and getting the skinny envelope and the fat packet. And I think I was interviewing for the Moorhead then, and the Moorhead scholarship at UNC. And so I'd write about like what I was doing. And I wrote a lot about tennis because I was a big tennis player. And, you know, I just, whatever, I write about anything. And so I got a lot of positive feedback. I mean, I still write for the Salisbury Post. I just wrote something for them. It was a very formative part of my career. And I will say, I'm taking too long to answer this question, but I will say that Rose Post was at the paper with me when I was there.
Rose Post, a legend in North Carolina journalism circles.
Yes. I feel like in so many ways, like I just be learning how to write from reading her was like a really important part of my like formation, I guess, as like a columnist or an essayist. Because if I was ever stuck on something or I didn't know quite how to land it to read, I mean, she might have been writing about a soldier coming home and I was writing about an adopt-a-thon, whatever. But like to be able to go in and read like the cadence of her voice and how she would, you know, tie everything together at the end, and the beginning always mirror the end, and things like that. Like I definitely feel like I got from her. And just the idea that you could be, you know, a woman in this sort of newsroom world and really make an impact and like have, you know, a big effect on people's lives, because she definitely did.
One important follow-up question. Did the squash actually look like Elvis?
Oh, it totally did.
When we come back, Christy Woodson Harvey talks about her online show, Friends in Fiction, and how it built a community during the pandemic.
Most of these people did not know each other at all. And they're people who are like best friends now because they met during this really dark time online. Like the thing your mom tells you to never do, never meet your online friends in real life. And man, oh man, have we ever done it.
That and more ahead on Southbound. Before we get back to this episode, I wanted to ask for a little help with something. If you enjoy Southbound, please give us a good rating and write us a review on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcast provider you have that allows such things. The more reviews and better ratings we get, the better chance there is that other listeners can find us. But to be honest, I'd just as soon you tell people about Southbound through good old word of mouth. If you could recommend it to just one person you know, somebody you might think would enjoy interesting conversations about the South, I'd be deeply grateful. If you have any thoughts about the show, guests to recommend, or anything that you think might make Southbound better, you can email me at ttomlinson@wfae.org. Thanks so much for giving us a little bit of your time. And now, back to my conversation with Christy Woodson Harvey. When did you start actually working on novels? When did that start to make itself known?
This is hilarious because now I am like, you were such a child and you did not know. I was about to turn 25. It was like 3 months before my 25th birthday. And I thought, I want to do something big. Like, I'm just going to do something really cool. Like, it wasn't necessarily like before I turned 25, but it was like, okay, you're turning 25. Like, let's get it together. What do you want to do? And I decided I was going to write a book. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to get published or, oh, I'm going to be an author. I was just like, I'm going to see if I can write a book. I've read so many of them. I love them. That was my favorite pastime. I loved reading my whole life. And I thought, I'm just going to see if I can write a book. And won't that be cool? And then, like, one day I can say to my grandkids, like, I wrote a book one time. And so I started writing and I was like, this is amazing. And I think what was amazing about it to me was that I had an idea of what the story was going to be. And I would sit down and start writing, and the story would become something else. And I did not know that was even possible. And it like hooked me. It's almost like I will not claim to have ever experienced this before because I have not. But when runners talk about when you get that like runner's high and a lot of it's hard, but you reach that point of like kind of euphoria. That's what it felt like to me. Like when you're just in flow like that, you know.
It's funny you mentioned that. I just yesterday, I talked to James Lee Burke for a upcoming podcast as well, and he was saying, he's like 87 years old. He's been doing this forever, and he says he still has periods where he basically blacks out. He writes and writes and writes, and he doesn't remember what he's written until he goes back and looks at it.
That's nuts. Okay, that does not happen to me. I know what I've written, but it's like I can feel the story. It's like I let myself, it's like I'm not thinking about it anymore. It's just coming. It's just like coming to me, and it's a really cool experience. So I fell in love with that, and I was like, this is great. And I think there's something to this. And I finished my first manuscript, and I thought, this isn't something that I want published. Like, this is not something that I want to look back when I'm 75 and think this was my first novel. But like, I felt that it was publishable, right? Like I felt like it's not the worst thing I've ever read, but I didn't spend a ton of time on it. I just kept going because I had all these other ideas, and I think it was finally my third manuscript that my husband, in fact, was like, "Are you going to just keep putting these in the closet, or did you think you might want to try to get published one day?" And I was like, "It's going to be hard, and there's going to be rejection, and it's so fun right now because it's just for me, and I don't have to worry about anything." And but I did eventually. I actually got a literary agent for a book that I wrote before my debut, Dear Carolina. It was actually a prequel to Dear Carolina. Dear Carolina was actually always meant to be a sequel. It was never meant to be a standalone novel. But then I won a writing contest for Dear Carolina, and there was an editor at Berkeley, and she bought my book out of the contest. And so that was my first book to get published. And even then, though, I think I thought, oh my gosh, this is so great. And like, I want to keep doing this, but who knows if I'll get to keep doing it. But wow, I'm going to have a book in the world. And that was kind of as far as I could even let myself think then.
I want to get to your YouTube show and podcast and all that stuff in just a second. But I want to ask about when I was watching one of those, I think it was with Louise Penny, maybe. Y'all were having a conversation about, like, what do you call the genre you work in? Y'all were having real trouble figuring that out. I mean, when people ask, like, what kind of books do you write? What do you tell them?
I still say Southern women's fiction. I mean, I do. I think, and not that only women read my books, because weirdly, we thought this was a fluke for a few years, but my publisher is really good about being able to pull data about who's reading my books and who's buying them. And I have a full quarter of my readership that is male, which I think is sort of surprising. But I feel like women's fiction doesn't necessarily mean fiction for women so much as women-centric fiction. And I think even my books that have very strong male leads, I mean, I have a couple that even have a male protagonist, but I think they're more like female-centric stories. And they're Southern because they're set in the South.
So I want to talk about this multimedia extravaganza you have, Friends in Fiction. So with three other well-known writers, how did all that start?
Oh my gosh. So this was the craziest. So Friends in Fiction is a web show and podcast that I have with Mary Kay Andrews and Kristen Harmel and Patty Callahan Henry. And we started it in 2020 during the pandemic. We all had books coming out and all of our tours were canceled. And we were quite frankly panicking because we are all very like tour centric authors. Like we go out on the road and we sell books that way. And so, and especially I think maybe for me, because I was newer. I mean, I was newer than the rest of them. So I think my fifth book was about to come out. And so you feel like at a fifth book, it's kind of a pivotal moment of like, is this working or is it, I mean, you're kind of at a crossroads there. And so I was very nervous, like, okay, is this going to sink this book that really had everything kind of going for it at that moment? It was actually Mary Kay's idea. She said, hey guys, like let's get together, let's talk. Mary Alice Monroe was actually one of our founding members, and then our friend Christina McMorris was actually on that first call with us too. And she was like, let's just go on Facebook and we'll all go live together on all of our pages, and we'll talk about our new books, and we'll remind everybody to support their independent bookstores during this time, because we were really worried about our indies and, you know, how they were going to fare through all of this. And, you know, we'll just see what happens. Like, that was it. There was no plan. And so we went live on Facebook, and I mean, we didn't think anyone would come. And I think we had like 1,000 viewers live the first night that we were on there. And we were like, whoa, people are really bored.
And hungry for, company, I
Yes,
guess.
exactly. Like they wanted something to do. And so we decided to do 7 episodes of Friends and Fiction. By then, all of our books would be out. The world would be back to normal. Of course, the world was not back to normal. And 4 and almost a half years later, we are still doing Friends and Fiction. We have a new episode that airs. It airs on Facebook and YouTube every Wednesday, and on the podcast every Friday. Yeah, it's been a huge surprise. It's been amazing. But I think you hit on something. I think there was something about the synergy of all of us on screen together, and we were taking people's questions live, and you know, that kind of thing. I think it made you feel like you were at a social event when there were no social events. But now, just the group that has formed around this, I mean, I think the Facebook group is about to hit 250,000 members. And the groups that come to these, you know, live events, and there it's just been something really special to watch not only the audience maybe connect with us or the authors that we bring on, but to connect with each other. It's like this reading community where most of these people did not know each other at all. And they're people who are like best friends now because they met during this really dark time online. Like the thing your mom tells you to never do, never meet your online friends in real life. And man, oh man, have we ever done it.
Well, and also it reminds me of you had talked about this earlier with your family and everybody kind of getting together at, every day at the coffee shop or whatever. And you have a similar group in your book that does the same thing. That was, especially during COVID, that was sort of the version of that, right? Everybody gathering just so you can have somebody else to talk to for a little while.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and we would look forward to Wednesday night so much because we knew we were going to get to be together, and we were going to get to, like, you know, be kind of in the presence of all of, you know, these other people that were out there kind of tuning in live with us. And it felt really special. And it's funny because none of us thought that we would be doing it 4.5 years later. And, you know, we've made some changes here and there to make it so that we can continue on, because we are touring a lot again now. And so it's hard to be live every single Wednesday night, which we were for 3.5 years. And so we've done some pre-taping and some things like that to make it work a little bit more. But yeah, I mean, I think we've kind of decided now, like, people are still watching. And if they're still watching, we're still going to come on. And we thought that would end. We thought the world will open up. No one's going to watch this anymore, and it's going to be over. And that hasn't really happened. So we feel very grateful.
I'm curious when you have a lot of friends who are similar successful writers that you see a lot or talk to a lot and that sort of thing. Do you talk shop in the sense where does anybody ever say like, man, I'm working on this book and I'm really stuck in this part. Could somebody help me there? Or is it mostly you talk about other things?
I would say it's a really good mix. So I would say it's mostly others. I don't know. I'd say it's 50-50 actually, because we talk all day, every day. Like, we have the text string that goes on and on. We had an hour and a half Zoom this morning. I talked to each of them on the phone probably at least several times a week. And so largely we talk about our lives, we talk about our families, talk about what's coming up. But yeah, we talk shop a lot. I mean, we talk a lot about the show, obviously, but we talk a lot about what's going on in the industry. And I would say that the, like, hey, I'm stuck on this part is probably the thing we do the least, but we definitely do it. And like, I just have had this whole like title situation where I like, we couldn't come up with the right. So we're like workshopping titles on it. Like, we do that kind of stuff constantly. But we have, on multiple occasions, there have been times where someone has been like, y'all, I'm really stuck. And we'll like all hop on a Zoom together and like figure it out and then move on.
Well, I wanted to ask about that because you've got the books you're writing, you've got the podcast and YouTube show. I'm curious, and you've got people like me wanting to do interviews with you, and you're going out on tour and all this stuff. So I'm curious if you have any time management tips for the rest of us, because you seem to be doing a lot.
Thank you, first of all. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for saying that. I do think I'm good at managing time. I will say that. Like, I don't know if that's braggy, but I do think I'm good at that. But one of the things that I do that I think is critical is when I am drafting a book, the book comes first, period. I get up in the morning, make my son breakfast, take him to school, those things. But I used to exercise. Like, I would like go to the gym, like go to gym class. Nope, don't do that anymore. Because then what happens is you're at the class with your friends, and then you go to coffee, and then you get home and you're like, I have 7,000 emails I have to answer. And then, it's 5:30 and you still haven't written. So I don't do any of that now. I take Will to school, and then when I'm in that clean brain space, it's like 8 a.m. No, I'm not a 5 a.m. or anything like that, but it's like 8 a.m. is when I love to write. I sit down, my brain feels kind of clear. I'm not on the phone yet. I'm not, everybody's problems haven't come to me yet, even though they're mostly my problems. They're like something with the book or something with the font or, whatever. But nothing's really coming yet. And so I write usually for about 2 hours, sometimes more, sometimes less. It just kind of depends. But I try to write, not I try to, I write 2,000 words a day at least. And if I'm having like a great day, I mean, I'll keep going. I mean, I might write for hours, and especially towards the end of a book. I mean, I will say to my husband and son, like, I love y'all. I probably won't see you for 3 days because I get so excited to finish the end of the book that I'm just like in my office and like, fit writing. Like, I might be writing at midnight, I might be writing at 2 a.m. Like, I just am so excited to finish the book. So that doesn't sound like good time management. That's not a tip, that's just truth. 8 to 10 is when I write. And then after that, I kind of do my first round of like emailing and everything like that. I really try, I have very, very organized office. You could see my bookshelves, but like everything behind me, like all of my Friends of Fiction books are in order. All of my blurb books are in order of like when they need to be read by and da 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 da. It's life. I mean, things fall apart. And I try to really be the person that's picking my son up from school and driving him to his 11,000 activities in the afternoon. And so I really do try to have my afternoons for that, but it gives me good reading time because, while he's like between practices, I'm reading and, all that. But yeah, I don't know that I'm like doing it that well, but it's working. And I think I also, my life is like a series of binges. So I'm like writing and then I'm promoting and then I'm writing again. It's very like, it's not super balanced, but we're holding it together.
So you said something in that answer that I wanted to kind of come back to about being really excited about something you were working on. And you talked about it gets close to the end of the book. You get really excited about it. I think something a lot of people have a hard time dealing with is how do you do it on the days when you don't feel excited?
And I think that's where just the pure, I mean, Ellen Hildebrand says this all the time, writing is a discipline, and that's what it is. And that's why I realized, I mean, this is like sort of comical, like that I'm going to say it like this, but I think writing is a discipline in the same way that like working out is a discipline. I don't ever want to, but like I do. I don't ever want to, but I do, but writing is different because I do want to write. So it's not that, but there are certainly days that like I want to do something else. I want to procrastinate. I don't feel inspired by this part of the story. I don't like the character, and I know I need to redo it. There, all those things happen, but I think I just absolutely make myself, I have to do it. Like, there's no, that's it. It's the top thing on the list, and nothing else can get done until the top thing on the list gets done. And sometimes it's not good. I mean, often it's not good. I mean, there are plenty of days where I am not inspired or where I don't think I wrote a single decent word. But I think there's something really mentally important about having a first draft. I won't say that for everyone. It's really important for me. Once I have a first draft, I'm like in the safe zone. Like, I've got a first draft. There is a book here. I might have to do a lot of work on it, but there is a story here with a beginning, middle, and end, and it's going to turn into something. And so I think that's kind of what I'm always like seeing, at the end. And I tell myself a lot, like, you've done this before and it always works out. But I'm like kind of the you this is ge my process is generally, I'm generally excited about the first draft. It's the editing that I dread. I love the first draft. The editing, I'm just like, ugh. And I don't know why, because the editing is when the book starts to get good, right? Like, that's when it starts to take shape and you take something that like wasn't fully formed and you really hammer in on it, and like it's when it starts to become something that you are proud for people to read. But it's the part I dread, and I don't know why.
It's more work, I think. The first draft is like you know, the romance part.
It is.
Right? And then the entity part is like, okay, we live together now. We've been married 20 years. We still love each other. How do you make it work day after day after
day? But it's your day to do the dishes.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, you're that's so perfect, Lisa and Tommy. Thank you. You have, like, really given me a psychological evaluation today that I needed.
Well,
you're right.
Feel free to use that on the road if you need
to.
So one last thing, and I'll let you go. So in this book, Happier Life, Bex, the grandmother, gives a lot of tips along the way for sort of how to do things, how to live. She keeps these detailed notebooks that people find later on and learn about her and her life from this information. And this may be kind of a woo-woo question. Do you feel like people can look at your books, you know, they're lined up on a bookshelf somewhere, 11 novels so far, and kind of figure out who you are from those, or figure out how you think people ought to live?
So I definitely think that people could read my 11 novels and figure out who I am. I mean, I think my voice is in all of these books for sure. But I will tell you that I have a very broad notion of how people should live, and that is however they want to. So I think that maybe what you would see are different bits and pieces of experiences of my own life, not maybe so much a value judgment about whether they're good or they're bad. There's so many things about Bex that, well, one, that remind me of my grandmother. I mean, those tips that are the beginning of every chapter, I did it the first couple of times and then I was like, why would I have done this? This is going to be a nightmare. And it wasn't at all. Like, there, I never even, like, when I say that I never even thought about any of them, I never even thought about any of them. They just, like came out of my head because they were just like her, or like from her. The reality is I don't live like Bex, and I think it's great if other people do, but I certainly don't think they need to. But yeah, if you read all my books, you know who I am. But it does make me laugh because there are things that I will write in a character that I am vehemently opposed to in my real life. And I will get these like nasty emails from people like, I can't believe that you told people to blah, blah, blah. I'm like, I'm sorry. Like, this is a book character. What are you talking about? It makes me laugh so hard. I'm like, I've written 12 books now, and three that have never been published. So 15, if I only wrote things that I believed in, we would be in trouble.
For a writer, everything might one day be material. Christy Woodson Harvey remembered the house somebody had abandoned back in Salisbury. She remembered how she felt driving into Beaufort for the first time. And 11 books into her career, those things worked their way into her prose. There's something about sharing a story that makes it grow. Every reader, every listener, folds in their own memories and experiences. When I read Christy's new book, A Happier Life, I thought of the grandmother on my father's side that I never knew. I wish she'd left something behind to help me understand the life she'd lived. And I wish there was a home somewhere that I could walk through just to see where she'd once been. I asked Christy there at the end if people could know her by reading her books. They probably could, but that's not really the point. Reading a book, if it's a good one, helps you know yourself. Even a summery romance set in a coastal town can help unravel our own personal mysteries. That's the magic of it. Southbound is a production of WFAE in Charlotte. Our editors are Lisa Wharf and Jen Lang. Our main theme music comes from Joshua Lee Turner. You can listen to this and other episodes of Southbound on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the NPR app, or wherever else you listen to podcasts. Subscribe for free to get each new episode sent to you when it's ready. You can also find Southbound on our website. Just go to wfae.org/podcast/southbound. See y'all next time. Thanks for listening.